Elaine Scarry, there are two hooks for this conversation. One is the congressional report last week finding major fault with the CIA and the FBI in preparing to defend us from something like 9/11. And then there's your own little book called Who Defended the Country, with a remarkable sort of outside-the-box observation that the Pentagon was not as effective as plain citizens were in responding to that awful emergency. I'd like you to start with the congressional report. How much comfort did you find in that?
I felt very happy and relieved that the Congress was looking closely at the actions taken by the CIA and the FBI and the amount of information and knowledge they had, and that they were willing to say that our intelligence agencies had let us down in coordinating information and protecting us. We've known since 9/11 that there were pretty large intelligence failures, and to the credit of the country and the media and the Congress, this has been a topic on everyone's mind, and we've all waited for the congressional report, and it will take us time to assimilate all that it reveals. But I think it's an important step.
How about an intelligence czar, which is what they seem to want? Would that help or not?
It's possible that it would help, but I think that what is shown is a kind of glacial inadequacy. It may be that an intelligence czar will remedy some of the problems, but I think the level of inadequacy, and I use that word not to find fault, but simply to say that there was no fit between the jobs that were needed to be done and the apparatus we had for carrying out those jobs. And the split between those two can't, in my view, somehow be solved by small repairs or small reorganizations. There are a number of problems here. One is that basically we have not been organizing ourselves in such a way that we're even intending to defend the country. One of the things the congressional report again and again looks at is the fact that our intelligence agencies were more prepared to see terrorism abroad than to see it at home, despite the fact that they had information about too many people taking odd flight school courses, and so on and so forth. And the fact that we now have something called the Department of Homeland Security is evidence of the fact that our own Department of Defense is not a Department of Homeland Defense. It's a Department of Global Adventure or Global Empire.
Elaine Scarry, I want to cut to the chase of your remarkable little book, Who Defended the Country? You say at one point early on, one key fact needs to be held on to and stated in a clear sentence. On September 11th, the Pentagon could not defend the Pentagon, let alone the rest of the country, even though, these are my words, the Pentagon had 1 hour and 20 minutes of warning that multiple planes had been taken in midair. What do you conclude from this?
Well, I think that the facts speak for themselves. I think that the fact that the Pentagon could not defend the Pentagon is an overwhelming fact that we need to stop and acknowledge. Not so that anyone will, you know, necessarily feel bad, although I'm sure people in the Pentagon do among themselves see it as a spectacular failure. But we need to stop and register the fact that for 50 years we've spoken about the fact that our Pentagon needs to act quickly, and in the name of speed, we have bypassed all kind of constitutional laws we have about how we will go about deliberating when we need to go to war. We've been told that there's no time for widespread deliberations among the citizenry. There's no time for careful deliberation by the Congress because we're living in a modern weapons world where people have to do things quickly. And what became clear on September 11th is that the speed argument does not have much reality. The Pentagon had a pretty long amount of time by the standard that the Pentagon itself has used for the last 50 years, where we all the time hear people speaking about doing things in a matter of minutes or doing things on hair...
Or seconds,
yes. In fact, the way our missile defense, if you read the July 18th issue of Science Magazine, that looks in great detail at our ability to defend the country against missiles, we're talking about, as that article makes clear, a window of hundreds of seconds in which we can act. And the view of the article in that July Science article is precisely that it's impossible. We can't possibly do it. But we've listened for decades to statements about doing things in a matter of minutes or doing things in a matter of seconds. And on September 11th, there was a large window of time, an hour and 21 minutes, in which we knew multiple planes had been taken, 55 minutes in which we knew that American Airlines 77 was probably one of the planes that had been taken by terrorists, and 20 minutes in which we knew with absolute certainty that it was one of the planes, because by that point we had not only seen that it was off course, that its radio was off, that its radar was off, that is its transponder that enabled it to be seen by secondary radar, that its radio with which it speaks with the airline company was off, but in addition to those very persuasive signs, at 9:25 that morning, a passenger on the plane, Barbara Olson, makes a direct phone call to the Department of Justice, and verifies that the plane is under the control of hijackers. And now 20 minutes remains, and nothing can be done to stop this plane from going into the Pentagon.
So the Pentagon can't defend itself with that notice. The contrast you draw, and I don't know anybody else would have thought of drawing it, is what happened inside Flight 93, where American citizens, for the most part, were making the best of an absolutely horrific situation. In the same amount of time, you write, 23 minutes, the passengers of Flight 93 were able to gather information, deliberate, vote, and act. What are we to conclude from that? Of course, they couldn't save themselves, but they did divert the plane.
That's right. They prevented the plane from going into a population center, and they had information about the World Trade Towers, and they were able to make the decision to themselves risk death or actually ensure their deaths and save the rest of us on the ground.
You've reconstructed those moments in long moments in the plane more carefully than anybody I've read. Explain what was going on.
Well, there really are six or seven steps that the passengers go through. The first step is they identify the fact that the plane is being held by hijackers. There were 24 phone calls made between 9:31 in the morning and 9:54 when we lose any information or when all people speaking with them lose contact with them. In that 23 minutes, they were able to identify the location of the hijackers throughout the planes, and then second, hear the story of the World Trade Towers, and each of the people was speaking to someone in his or her own family or to a loved one and getting the information from disparate sources. Then they go to a third step, which is verify the fact that the World Trade Towers story is true. Jeremy Glick, one of the passengers, explicitly says to his wife that this story is circulating on the plane, and he asks her, is it true? And she confirms that it is true. Then they go on to a fourth step, which is to consult with each other about what action they're going to take. And we have multiple reports from various spouses and family members about the plans they had. We know that Jeremy Glick told his family that a number of people on the plane planned to rush the hijackers. Todd Beamer, another passenger, told a Verizon phone supervisor that a group of people planned to take the terrorists. Tom Burnett, another passenger, told somebody in his family, a group of us is going to do something. And so we know that they were contemplating action, and they were not only talking among themselves, they were talking with people they trusted on the ground. And when you look at historically at the arrangements that were made for protecting this country, you keep coming upon the phrase that the military must be held within a civilian frame, that military action must be measured against the norms of everyday life and brought into contact with the people with whom one has dinner at night, or with whom one goes to church, or with whom one goes to a picnic or a movie or whatever. And that was essentially what was happening in these first four steps. Then they go on to another crucial step, the fifth step of taking a vote. Jeremy Glick, one of the passengers, explicitly describes that act of taking a vote as it's underway. Then they...
It's amazing. I mean, a sort of a town meeting of the air, in the air, so to speak. A lot of Paul Revere legends sort of coming back to life here. Go on.
No, it is. Paul Revere is a good image of it. We have a wonderful construction of that story by the historian David Fisher, and it goes person by person, house by house, and that's true here too. The person by person is going through this process.
Paul Revere with a cell phone.
Paul Revere with a cell phone, or with an airplane phone on the back of the seat of the airplane, exactly. And at a certain point, then the passengers even prepare for death. They know what is coming, so that we have the reports of passenger Todd Beamer reciting aloud the 23rd Psalm, or Tom Burnett asks his wife to pray while the passengers are acting. We know that another passenger, C.C. Lyles, leaves a recording for her husband when she can't reach him, of herself praying, and then when she does reach him, she prays with him. And then they go through another step, which is to actually take leave of the people they love, and explicitly tell them that they love them. And in the one case where a passenger is speaking to someone not in his family, he asks the person with whom he's speaking, the Verizon phone operator, Lisa Jefferson, to relay the message of his love. And people are reciprocating. So the passenger named Elizabeth Wainio, her stepmother, tells her, "I've got my arms around you." Mm-hmm. And then the final moment when they act. And several passengers left the phone lines open. One of them tells his wife that he asks his family to hold the phone until he comes back. Another passenger leaves it open, and we don't know whether he expected to come back or whether he wanted to leave it open as an act of record keeping. And we know that C.C. Lyles calls out, "They're doing it, they're doing it." And Sandy Bradshaw, a stewardess on the plane, who had herself devised very canny plans for dealing with the hijackers, she says to her husband, with whom she's speaking on the phone, "I've got to go now. Everyone's rushing to first class." So we have even though the tapes have not been made available to the public, of tapes that were happening in the, that were recording in the cockpit, we actually have a pretty elaborate record of, as you say, the town meeting or the small legislative assembly that acted on that plane. And it's important to go back to what you said earlier, that this is the same amount of time that the Pentagon had to defend the Pentagon. Actually, it's much less time, because in the case of Flight 77, they actually had 55 minutes in which they knew that multiple planes were taken, that the planes intended to do maximum harm because one of the World Trade Towers had already been hit, and that Flight 77 was almost certainly one of the planes. So that's within 55 minutes. What we've just been talking about for Flight 93, the plane that the passengers brought down in Pennsylvania, is 23 minutes.
This is an amazingly stirring, to give you goosebumps, I don't want to say romance, it was a reality of people acting to the best of their ability and very effectively to a certain point in their own defense. You build on this a kind of recommendation a plea for an egalitarian or democratic model of national defense and homeland security. You have a wonderful line in the book. You say, the destination, speaking as a citizen now, and we're all in on it, the destination for which we purchased tickets was a country where no one was arrested without their names being made public, a country that did not carry out wars without the authorization of Congress, and the widespread debate among the population that such a congressional declaration necessitates, a country that does not threaten to use weapons of mass destruction. Why, you ask, are we sitting quietly in our seats? What should we be doing, and how could we, in this incredibly high-tech, dangerous world, how could we be rebuilding a democratic defense?
I think that it would involve a lot of work on our part, and I think that we owe it to ourselves and to the country to actually carry out that work. I think that it would have to begin with conversations. You know, maybe we'd have to follow the model of the passengers on Flight 93 and actually have town meetings ourselves. We've recently seen the reanimation of the town meeting and of town councils in the very admirable work that various town councils have done in taking action against the USA Patriots Act. But I think that could again be a forum for our own discussions about whether we have adequate defense in this country, and of course the street and homes and cafes and libraries and classrooms should also be the kind of arena in which these questions are asked. It may very well be that one thing we need to do is to consider bringing back the draft, though that's an uncomfortable topic. It's something that a lot of people have begun to see may be necessary. Right now, we have lost contact with our own military. That is puts the military in jeopardy. It certainly puts the civilian world in jeopardy. And the only way to heal that is to be true to what the Constitution actually required, which was that military responsibilities be distributed across the full citizenry. And that doesn't mean, that doesn't say anything about how much weaponry we would have or whether we'd have any weaponry. Maybe we'd decide to be a wholly pacifist country that didn't ever intervene in other areas in the world. The issue is prior to any question of how much enduring power we would have.
The draft would certainly bring this conversation back to everybody's breakfast table, that's for sure. In the media, do you find this being discussed in a way that sounds realistic to you?
The representative, Charles Rangel from New York, certainly tried to bring it to the media's attention, and he did. I think that he...
I missed it. What did he say?
He said we need to have the draft back. He said. He said that.
I'm thinking of the of a democratic defense system more broadly.
Oh, has there been much discussion of it? I don't think there has been much discussion of it. No, we see that we have a problem. We see that we've just carried out a war against Iraq with not a single drop of evidence that Iraq was connected to 9/11, and apparently with no evidence that they were making weapons of mass destruction, and yet we've somehow found ourselves there. Imagine if we had a draft, what the standard of evidence would have been before you or I would have been willing to take leave from our jobs and go over there and do this, or before we'd be willing to see one of our children or one of our siblings go over there and do this. The standard of evidence would have been much higher. We've been through a period where we've actually listened to the president say, that's the interesting thing about being president, you don't need to explain what you're doing. We've been through a period where we've listened to a president feel that it doesn't matter that his claims to the country about nuclear weapons haven't been borne out. My own view, and I think this is important, is that even if Iraq had been making a nuclear weapon, There's a big question about whether we should have gone in there when we ourselves have thousands and thousands of weapons, and when we ourselves, in a 1995 court case in the International Court of Justice, defended against many other countries of the world the right, our right to have thousands of nuclear weapons. So it's, to me, a kind of non sequitur, a kind of just painful double standard to imagine that you could use as the basis for invading another country the fact that they might have one nuclear weapon. But all that we can just put to the side, since they apparently have zero nuclear weapons, and apparently we're not on their way to making any.
Let me ask, by the way, here, Elaine Scarry, I know as a student of literature and beauty, a marvelous writer, but when did you get into all of this knowledge about planes? First TWA 800, and what brought it down, but now suddenly national defense and 9/11.
Actually, long ago, in a book that I published in 1985, The Body in Pain, I looked at length at situations of willfully inflicted injury. And I had been looking at the way in which the pain, the physical pain of other people, because it's so hard to express, it sometimes causes us to be able to be in the presence of people who are in pain without knowing it, and even worse, to actually inflict it ourselves. As a result of that work, my studies for that particular book went in two directions. Actually, it showed that they were the underside and overside of a single direction, namely, on the one hand, situations such as torture and war, where the work of the human imagination, human creation, all those things that one might associate with literature, for example, mm-hmm. were simply undone and aped. And on the other hand, all the things that we as citizens, and also we as members of a very big and ongoing civilization, try to do to diminish physical pain. And as a result of that, my work since that time has either followed out one of those roads or the other, either the road of creation and the things we do to try and diminish pain, or looked at situations of willfully inflicted injury and to try and see what's going wrong. So for a long time since writing that book, I've actually been working on the way in which we have constitutional requirements that are utterly incompatible with the arrangements we have for nuclear weapons in our own country. We are bypassing the important deliberative gates that were supposed to be in place to prevent us from injuring other people. And we've just put these aside as though it doesn't matter, as though giving up our own social contract doesn't matter. And what I'm trying to do in this work is show that it does very much matter. Now, just as for this little book that you've been talking about today, Who Defended the Country, I can show the relation of it to that larger project. As I worked on the legal and moral arguments for what is wrong with our military, very often people would say to me, but you're forgetting we live in a fast world. When Locke was writing, or even when Hobbes was writing, or when our own Constitution was written, we didn't have this jet-set life in the fast lane world. They had no idea how quickly we'd have to act. So, in other words, the speed argument was always going to trump the moral argument, was always going to trump the legal argument. What happened on 9/11 was that it became clear that the speed argument is a false argument. In my own view, even if our military arrangements did enable us to act quickly, it wouldn't justify the kind of abridgment of all our legal obligations and our moral obligations. But now, for the record, it's got to be starkly clear to everyone that the speed argument is simply untrue.
On the other hand, though, is the citizen argument true that you and I and our neighbors, with a sense of turf, with a trust in each other and practice at it, could actually sustain the security of this homeland against the real enemies that we're pretty sure we have?
I think it's our best hope. I think that it may not be a perfect form of defense, but I think it's the best we can possibly do. And it's not as though that assertion that I just made, the sentence that I just made, doesn't need lots of testing. It needs to be debated. It needs to be called into question. I need to hear, and other people who believe the same thing I do need to hear, the counterarguments and address them. But I believe they can be addressed. Just, for example, one of the things that people may feel is, well, look, if another country has a nuclear weapon, how are we individual citizens acting just with our own rifles or whatever? How are we possibly going to defend ourselves? And that's a circular argument. The reason right now nuclear weapons are spreading from country to country is because we have them. In that International Court of Justice case where 87 countries went in and asked that nuclear weapons be declared illegal, including North Korea, by the way, that didn't yet have a nuclear weapon, including India, that didn't yet have a nuclear weapon, and other countries such as Qatar said that the signers of the Non-Proliferation Treaty were getting very impatient with countries such as the United States that themselves had weapons, and where those signers had understood that the holders of weapons would be giving them up, and they were making no move in that direction. Okay, now, if we really want other countries to give up nuclear weapons or to abstain from getting them, that can't possibly happen unless we give them up ourselves. And once we give them up ourselves, or if we, as a world in concert, begin to do this, then we're talking about having to defend ourselves only against conventional weapons, and that I'm confident we can do.
President Bush has said a number of times, sort of, when it comes to the crunch, our real defense against terrorism is to go get them, is to smoke them out of their holes and this kind of thing. It's a different matter from defending us. How much confidence does that give you?
It gives me no confidence. I mean, let's look at it this way. The arrangements, the constitutional arrangements, said you have to distribute authority to the whole country. Now we have a form of weaponry that allows us president to act alone and, if necessary, even use a nuclear weapon. And he has several times, President Bush has several times, made it clear that even nuclear weapons are on the table right now for what he's willing to do. Now, a nuclear weapon allows one person to take action against millions of people. But that means that one person on the other side can take action against millions of people. That is, nuclear weapons are terrorist weapons. And right now, we have terrorist arrangements in our own military. They allow a small number of people to injure a large number of people. If you have democratic self-defense, your protection of the country comes from the fact that you've got more people willing to affirm that form of government, and therefore you will, using Patrick Henry's language, put your hand to it, put your heart to it, stand behind it. But if you're going to allow a kind of technology that allows one person to make these decisions and bring harm, then there's no protection for anyone. There's no protection for anyone because there are always going to be, you can't persuade every individual on earth not to use these things. You may be able to prevent your own president or another president to abstain from using them for another 5 years or another 7 years, although we know various of our presidents have come close. But are you going to go around and get every would-be terrorist to abstain from using them? The only way to do that is to, rid them from the world altogether.
Citizens get to know Elaine Scarry better by reading this book called Who Defended the Country? Elaine Scarry is the Walter M. Cabot Professor of Aesthetics and the General Theory of Value at Harvard University. The book, again, is Who Defended the Country? Elaine Scarry, thank you enormously for this visit.
Thank you for having me.